tell you. Because when we get home, if we ever get home, you won't care. She paused, breathing as if she'd been running. Okay, fine. I'm going to take a shower. If you think about following me into the bathroom to talk, I'll shoot you. You don't have a gun, Julian pointed out. It wasn't a helpful thing to say. Emma stalked into the bathroom and slammed the door behind her. A moment later, there was the sound of running water. Julian sank into the bed. After having his soul wrapped in cotton wool for so long, the new rawness of emotion felt like razor wire cutting into his heart every time it expanded with a breath. It wasn't just pain. There was the bright current of joy that was seeing Livy, hearing her voice, of pride in watching Emma burn like fire in the Arctic, like the northern lights. A voice seemed to ring in his head, clear as a bell. It was the Seelie Queen's voice.
Have you ever wondered how we lure mortals to live amongst fairies and serve us, son of thorns? We choose those who have lost something and promise them that which humans desire most of all, a cessation to their grief and suffering. Little do they know that once they enter our lands, they are in a cage and will never again feel happiness. You are in that cage, boy.
The queen was deceitful, but sometimes right. Grief could be like a wolf tearing your insides, and you would do anything to make it stop. He remembered his despair as he looked in the mirror in Alicante, and knew he had lost Livy, and would soon lose Emma too. He had gone to Magnus like a shipwrecked man struggling onto a lonely rock, knowing he might die the next day of heat or thirst, but desperate to escape the tempest. And then the tempest had been gone. He had been in the eye of the hurricane, the storm around him, but he had been untouched. It had felt like a cessation to suffering. Only now did he recognize what he couldn't see before. That he had been going through life with a black hole at the center of him. A space like the emptiness between portals. Even at the moments when an emotion was so strong it seemed to pierce the veil, he had felt it at a sort of colorless, glassy remove. Ty atop Livy's pyre. Emma, as the thorns of the hedge tore at her. He could see her now, all black and white, the only spots of color where the blood had been drawn. There was a knock on the door. Julian's throat was too tight for him to speak, but it didn't seem to matter. Cameron Ashdown barged in anyway, carrying a pile of clothes. He dumped them into the wardrobe, went back to the hallway, and returned with a box of canned food, toothpaste, soap, and other basics. Dropping it onto the desk, he rolled his shoulders back with an exaggerated sigh. Jeans and turtlenecks, gloves and boots. If you go back outside, cover up as much as you can to hide your runes. There's concealer, too, if you want to get fancy. Need anything else? Julian gave him a long look. Yeah, he said finally. Actually, I do. Cameron had only just gone off, muttering, when Julian heard the water in the bathroom switch off. A moment later, Emma appeared, wrapped in a towel, cheeks pink and glowing. Had she always looked like that? Such intense colors. The gold of her hair, black marks against her pale skin, the soft brown of her eyes. I'm sorry, he said as she reached for the clothes on the bed. She froze. I'm only just starting to understand how sorry I am. She went into the bathroom and came out a moment later dressed in black cargo pants and a green tank top. The permanent marks twining her arms looked stark and startling, a reminder that no one else here had them. Whoever was eyeballing our sizes has way overestimated my attributes, she said, buckling her belt. The bra they gave me is huge. I could wear it as a hat. Cameron barged back in without knocking again. Got what you asked for, he said,
and dumped a pile of pencils and a Canson sketch pad into Julian's lap. I have to admit, it's a first. Most newbies ask for chocolate.
Do you have chocolate? Emma said.
No, said Cameron, and stomped back out of the room. Emma watched him go with a bemused expression.
I really like this new Cameron, she said. Who knew he had it in him to be such a badass? He was such a nice guy, but...
He always had a kind of a secret side, Julian said.
He wondered if there was something about suddenly getting his emotions back that meant he didn't feel like covering things up. Maybe he'd regret it later. Still.
A while ago, he approached Diana because he was pretty sure Anselm Nightshade was murdering werewolf children. He couldn't prove it, but he had some good reasons for thinking it. His family kept telling him to drop it, that Nightshade had powerful friends. So he brought it to us, to the Institute.
That's why you had Nightshade arrested, said Emma, realizing. You wanted the Clave to be able to search his house.
Diana told me they found a basement full of bones, said Julian. Werewolf children. Just like Cameron said. They tested the stuff in the restaurant, and there was death magic all over the place. Cameron was right. And he stood up to his family in his own way. And he did it for downworlders that he didn't know.
You never said anything, Emma said.
Not about Cameron or about you. Why you really got Anselm arrested. There are people who still blame you. He gave her a rueful smile. Sometimes you have to let people blame you. When the only other option is letting bad things happen. Doesn't matter what people think. She didn't reply. When he glanced over at her, she looked as if she'd forgotten all about Cameron and Nightshade.
Her eyes were wide and luminous as she reached out to touch a few of the prismacolors that had rolled onto the bed.
You ask for art supplies? She whispered.
Julian looked down at his hands. All this time, since the spell, I've been walking around, missing the whole center of myself. But the thing is, I didn't even notice. Not consciously. But I felt it. I was living in black and white, and now the color is back. He exhaled. I'm saying it all wrong.
No, Emma said. I think I get it. You mean that the part of you that feels is also the part of you that creates things?
They always say fairies steal human children because they can't make art or music of their own. Neither can warlocks or vampires. It requires mortality to make art. The knowledge of death, of things limited. There's a fire inside us, Emma. And as it blazes, it burns us. And the burning causes pain. But without its light, I cannot see to draw.
Then draw now, she said, her voice husky.
She pressed several pencils into his open hand and began to turn away.
I'm sorry, he said again. I shouldn't burden you.
You're not burdening me, she said, still facing away. You're reminding me why I love you.
The words caught at his heart, sharp with a painful joy. You're not off the hook, though, she added, and went over to the wardrobe.
He left her alone to rifle through the pairs of socks and shoes, looking for something that might fit.
He wanted to talk to her. Talk to her forever, about everything. But that had to be at her discretion, not his.
Instead, he put pencil to paper and let his imagination go. Let the images that rose up inside him and captured his brain flow out in Alicante silver and sealy green, in unsealy black and blood red. He drew the king on his throne, pale and powerful and unhappy. He drew Annabel holding Ash's hand. He drew Emma and Cortana surrounded by thorns. He drew Drusilla, all in black, a murder of crows circling behind her.
He was conscious that Emma had come to lie down beside him and was watching him with quiet curiosity, her head propped on her arm. She was half asleep, lips parted, when the door banged open again. Julian threw the sketchbook down.
Look, Cameron. But it wasn't Cameron. It was Livy. She had taken off her Sam Brown ammo belt, but otherwise looked much the same. In the brighter light of the bedroom, Julian could see the shadows smudged under her eyes.
"Cameron said you asked for a sketch pad and pencils," she said in a near whisper. Julian didn't move. He half felt as if any movement would spook her, as if he were trying to lure a nervous forest creature closer.
"Do you want to see?"
Julian held out the sketch pad. She took it and flipped through it, slowly and then faster. Emma was sitting up now, clutching one of the pillows. Livy thrust the sketchbook back at Julian. She was looking down. He couldn't see her face, only twin fringes of dark lashes. He felt a twinge of disappointment.
"She doesn't believe me. The pictures meant nothing to her. I'm nothing to her."
"No one draws like my brother,"
she said, taking a deep breath and letting it out slowly. She lifted her head and looked directly at Julian, with a sort of bewilderment that was half hurt, half hope.
"But you do.
You remember when I tried to teach you how to draw? When you were 9, said Julian, "and you snapped all of my pencils?" Something almost like a smile touched the edges of Livy's mouth. For a moment she was familiar, Livy, despite the scars and black leather. A second later, it was as if a mask had passed across her face, and she was a different Livia, a rebel leader, a scarred warrior. "You don't need to try to convince me anymore," she said. She turned away, her movements precise and military. "Finish getting cleaned up. I'll meet you 2 in the main office in an hour."
"Did we ever date in this world?" Emma said. "You know, you and me?"
Cameron nearly fell down several metal steps. They were in the maze of stairs and catwalks that crisscrossed the inside of the Bradbury building. "Of course not." Emma felt mildly stung. She knew it wasn't a big deal, considering, but sometimes you want to focus on something trivial to take your mind off the apocalypse. Cameron in her world had been almost embarrassingly devoted, always coming back after they broke up, sending love notes and flowers and sad llama pictures.
"You were always with Julian," Cameron added. "Aren't you together in your world?"
"I'm right here," Julian said in the deceptively mild tone that meant he was annoyed.
"I mean, yes," Emma said. "At least, we're on and off. Sometimes very on, sometimes very off. You and I dated briefly, is all."
"We really don't have time for that kind of personal drama here," Cameron said. "It's hard to focus on your love life when giant spiders are chasing you."
Cameron was pretty funny here, Emma thought. If he'd been this amusing at home, their relationship might have lasted longer. "When you say giant, how giant exactly?" she said. "Bigger than dumpsters?"
"Not the babies," Cameron said, and gave them a horrible smile. "We're here. Go on in, and don't tell Livy we dated in your world, because it's weird."
They found Livy in another repurposed office. This one had clearly once been more of a loft, big and airy and probably full of light, before the windows had been covered. Strips of brick alternated with polished wood on the walls, and dozens of vintage fruit labels advertising California apples, pears, and oranges hung between the boarded-up windows. A group of 4 sleek, modern couches formed a square around the glass coffee table. Livy was lounging on one of the couches, drinking a glass of something dark brown.
"That's not alcohol, is it?" Julian sounded appalled. "You shouldn't be drinking."
"You'll be drinking tomorrow," Livy said, and pointed at a bottle of Jack Daniels on the glass table.
"Just saying,"
she waved a hand. "Sit down." They settled themselves on the couch opposite her. There was a fireplace in the room, too, but the grate had been plugged with metal some time ago. Someone with a sense of humor had painted flames on the metal. It was too bad. Emma would have liked a fire. It would have felt like something natural. Livy turned her glass around in her scarred hands.
"So, I believe you," she said. "You are who you say you are, which means I know what you want to ask me."
"Yeah," Julian said. He cleared his throat. "Mark," he said. "Ty. Helen and Drew."
"But you also probably want to get out of here," Livy interrupted.
Since you ended up here by accident and your world sounds like a much better place.
We have to leave, Emma said. There are people at home who could be hurt or even killed if we don't come back.
But we want to take you with us, Julian said.
Emma had known he was going to say it. They hadn't discussed it, but it had never been a question. Of course Julian would want Livy to come back with them. Livy gave a long, slow nod.
Right, she said. Do you have any reason to think that there's any way you can get back at all? Interdimensional travel isn't exactly easy.
We'd only just started to discuss it, Emma said. But we'll think of something.
She spoke with more confidence than she felt. Livy held up a hand.
If there's any chance you can get away, are you really sure that you want to know what happened to everyone? Because I wish every single day that I didn't.
Without taking his eyes off Livy, Julian said, What I wish is that I could have been here for you. Livy's gaze was distant.
You were, I guess. Both of you.
She pulled her knees up under her.
You saved our lives when you sacrificed yourselves to get us out of Manhattan the day it fell.
Emma shivered.
New York? Why were we in New York?
The Battle of the Burren was when everything went wrong, said Livy. Clary was there, Alec and Isabel Lightwood, Magnus Bane, and Helen and Aline, of course. They were winning. Jace was under Sebastian's thrall, but Clary was wielding Glorious, the sword of the Angel of Paradise. She was about to break him free when Lilith appeared. She cast the sword into hell and cut Clary down. Helen and the others were lucky to escape with their lives. That was Sebastian's great victory. After that, he joined forces with the Fair Folk. They stormed Alicante while we hid in the Hall of Accords. The Shadow Hunters fought. Our father fought. But Sebastian was too powerful. As Alicante fell to his forces, a group of warlocks opened up a portal for the children. Just people under 15. We had to leave Helen and Mark behind. Drew was screaming as they ripped her out of Helen's arms and drove us through the portal to Manhattan. Katerina Loss and Magnus Bane had set up a temporary shelter there. The war raged on in Idris. We got a message from Helen. Mark had been taken by the Fair Folk. She didn't know what they would do to him. I still don't know. I hope he's in Faerie and it's green and bright and he's forgotten all of us.
He hasn't, Julian said in a low voice. Mark doesn't forget.
Livy just blinked, fast, as if her eyes stung. Helen and Aline hung on, fighting. Sometimes we got a fire message from them. We heard that strange gray patches started to appear in Brosselin Forest. They called them the Blight. They turned out to be doorways for demons.
Doorways for demons?
Emma demanded, sitting up straight. But Livy was caught up in her story, turning her glass over and over in her hand so fast Emma was surprised it hadn't started sparking.
Demons flooded into Idris. The Fair Folk and Hindarkin drove the Shadow Hunters out of Alicante. And the demons finished them off. We were in New York when we heard Idris had fallen. Everyone wanted to know the names of the dead, but there was no information. We couldn't find out what had happened to Helen and Aline. If they'd lived or been Hindarkin, we didn't know.
We did know we wouldn't be safe for long.
Sebastian didn't care about keeping secrets from the human world. He wanted to burn it all down. Demons began to appear everywhere, running rampant, slaughtering humans in the streets. The blight spread, appearing all over the world. It poisoned everything it touched, and the warlock started to sicken. After 2 months, the shelter was destroyed. The streets were full of monsters, and the warlocks were getting sicker and sicker. The more powerful they were, the more magic they'd used, the quicker they got sick, and the more likely they were to turn into demons. Katerina fled so she wouldn't hurt anyone. You heard what happened to Alec and Magnus. The shelter collapsed, and the kids spilled into the streets. She looked at Julian.
It was winter. We had nowhere to go. But you kept us together. You said at all costs we stay together. We live because we're together. We never leave each other.
Julian cleared his throat. That sounds right. Livy's eyes bored into him.
Before she left, Katerina Loss arranged for a bunch of trains to take Shadowhunter and Downworlder kids across the country. The demons were spreading east to west, and the rumor was that California was pretty clear. We left from White Plains Station. We walked all night, and you carried Tavi. He was so hungry. We were all hungry. You kept trying to give us your food, especially Ty. We got to the station and the last train was leaving. That's when we saw them. The end darkened. They came for us in their red gear like a rain of blood. They were going to kill us all before we got on that train. You didn't even kiss us goodbye, Livy said, her voice remote. He just shoved us toward the trains. He shouted at us to get on, told me to look after the younger ones. And you went for the Andarkand with your swords out. We could see you fighting them as the train pulled out. Just the two of you. And 50 Andarkand in the snow. At least we went down protecting them, Emma thought. It was cold comfort. And then there were four, Livy said and reached for the whiskey bottle. Me, Ty, Drew, and Tavi. I did what you said. I looked after them. The trains inched through the winter. We met Cameron somewhere around Chicago. We'd all started going from train to train by then, trading food for matches, that sort of thing. Cameron said we should go to L.A., that his sister was there, and she said things were okay. Of course, when we hit Union Station, it turned out Paige Ashdown had joined the Legion of the Star. That's what they were calling themselves. Traitors, we called them. She was standing there, grinning bloody murder, with a dozen Andarkand around her. Cameron gave me a shove, and Ty and I ran. We were dragging Drew and Tavi with us. They were crying and screaming. They thought we were going home. I don't think we realized until then how bad things had gotten. Demons hunted unsworn humans through the streets, and there was nothing we could do. Our marks were fading. We were getting weaker every day. Runes and seraph blades didn't work. We had nothing to fight demons with. And so we hid. Like cowards. By the angel, Livy. You can't have been expected to do anything else. You were 10, Emma said. No one says by the angel anymore. Livy poured out a measure of Jack Daniels and recapped the bottle. At least it wasn't cold. I remembered what you'd said, Jules, to take care of the younger ones. Ty isn't... He wasn't really younger than me. But he was shattered. His whole heart was broken when we lost you. He loved you so much, Jules. Julian didn't speak. He was pale as the snow in Livy's story. Emma slid her hand across the couch, touched her fingers to his. They were icy. This world was the pure, distilled essence of his nightmares, Emma thought. A place where siblings had been ripped from him, where he couldn't protect them as the world fell down around them in darkness and flame. We slept in alleyways, in the abandoned houses of murdered humans, Livy said. We scrounged for food in supermarkets. We never stayed in the same place for more than 2 nights. Tavi screamed himself to sleep in my arms every night. But we were careful. I thought we were careful. We slept inside rings of salt and iron. I tried, but... She took a swallow of whiskey. Emma would have choked. Livy seemed used to it. One night, we were sleeping on the street, in the ruins of the Grove. There were still stores with food and clothes there. I'd surrounded us with salt, but a Shinigami demon came from above. It was a fast blur with wings and talons like knives.
It snatched Tavi away from me. We were both screaming. She took a ragged breath. There was this stupid ornamental fountain. Tai jumped up onto the side and attacked the Shinigami with a throwing knife. I think he hit it, but without runes, it just... you can't hurt them. It was still holding Tavi. It just turned around and slashed out with a talon and cut Tai Tai's throat. She didn't seem to notice or care that she'd called him by his baby name. She was gripping her glass tightly, her eyes blank and haunted. My Tai. He fell into the fountain, and it was all water and blood. The Shinigami was gone. Tavi was gone. I hauled Tai out, but he was dead in my arms. Dead in my arms. Emma tightened her grip on Julian's hand, seeing him in the council hall dais, holding Livy as the life and the blood went out of her. I kissed him. I told him I loved him. And I went and got a jug of gasoline and burned his body so the demons wouldn't find it. Livy's mouth twisted. And then it was just me and Drew. Livia. Julian leaned forward, but his sister held up a hand, as if to ward off whatever he was going to say next. Let me finish, she said. I've gotten this far. She took another drink and closed her eyes. After that, Drew stopped talking. I told her we were going to go to the Institute and get help. She didn't say anything. I knew there wasn't any help there. But I thought maybe we could join the Legion of the Star. I didn't care anymore. We were walking along the highway when a car pulled up. It was Cameron. He could see we were bloody and starving, and that there were only two of us. He didn't ask questions. He told us about this place, the Bradbury Building. He was tapped into the resistance. It was tiny then, and there were two ex-shadow hunters who had once hunted a demon here. They said it was an old, strong building full of salt and iron, easy to lock down. Plus, because of the LAPD leasing space, there was a stockpile of weapons here. We joined up with the others and helped them break in. Even Drew helped, though she still wasn't talking. We started to reinforce the building and spread the word that those resisting Sebastian were welcome here. People came from New York, from Canada and Mexico, from all over. We slowly built up the population, made a haven for refugees. So Drew is still... Emma began eagerly, but Livy went on. 2 years ago, she went out with a scouting party. Never came back. It happens all the time. Did you look for her? Julian said. Livy turned a flat gaze on him. We don't go after people here, she said. We don't do rescue missions. They get more people killed. If I disappeared, I wouldn't expect anyone to come after me. I'd hope they wouldn't be that stupid. She set her glass down. Anyway, now you know. That's the story. They stared at each other, the three of them, for a long moment. Then Julian stood up. He went around the table and lifted Livy up and hugged her, so tightly that Emma saw her gasp in surprise. Don't push him away, she thought. Please, don't. Livy didn't. She squeezed her eyes shut and grabbed onto Julian. They stood hugging each other for a long moment, like two drowning people clinging to the same life raft. Livy pressed her face against Julian's shoulder and gave a single, dry sob. Emma stumbled to her feet and over to them, not inserting herself into the hug, but gently stroking Livy's hair. Livy raised her head from Julian's shoulder and offered her a tiny smile. We're going to get back to our world, Julian said. Tai is alive there. Everyone's alive there. We'll take you with us. You belong there. Not here. Emma waited for Livy to ask them about her own fate in their world, but she didn't. Instead, she pulled a little away from Julian and shook her head,
not angrily, but with immense sadness. "There are things I have to do here," she said. "It's not like we're just walled up here waiting to die. We're fighting, Jules."
"Jesus lives," he said in a half-broken voice. "It's so dangerous."
"I know," she said, and patted his face lightly, the way she had sometimes when she was a very little girl, as if the familiar shape of his features was reassuring. Then she stepped away, breaking the hug. She smoothed her hair back and said, "I didn't tell you about the Silent Brothers."
"The Silent Brothers?" Emma was puzzled.
"When Idris fell, the Silent Brothers were killed, but before they died, they sealed the Silent City with the mortal cup and the mortal sword inside it. No one could get in, not even Sebastian, and he wants to, desperately."
"Why does he want the mortal instruments?" said Julian.
"He has a version of the cup that controls the Undarkened," said Livy. "But he wants to master us. He thinks if he can get the mortal instruments together, he can control what remains of the Nephilim, turn us from rebels into slaves."
"Sebastian said something on the beach," Emma recalled, "about the mortal instruments."
"We have people on the inside, like Cameron," said Livy. "The rumor is that Sebastian is getting closer to figuring out a way into the city." She hesitated. "That would be the end of us. All we can do is hope he doesn't make it, or that the progress is slow. We can't stop him." Emma and Julian stared at each other. There was no way of knowing whether Sebastian's plan would work, but the possibility was bad enough.
"What if we can find a warlock?" Emma suggested. "Someone who could help you get into the Silent City first."
Livy hesitated.
"I like your enthusiasm," she said. "But the warlocks are all dead. Or demons."
"Hear me out," Emma said. She was thinking of Christina in the Unseelie Court.
"It's not the ley lines, it's the blight.
You were talking about how demons came into Idris through patches of blight. We have those in our world, too, though demons aren't coming through yet. And our warlocks are also getting sick. The oldest and the most powerful first. They're not turning into demons. Not yet, anyway. But the illness is the same."
"And?" Julian said. He was looking at her with thoughtful respect. Emma had always been praised for her fighting skills, but only Julian had been there to reassure her that she was smart and capable, too. She realized suddenly how much she missed that.
"In our world, there's one warlock who is immune to the sickness," said Emma.
"Tessa Gray.
If she's immune here, too, she might be able to help us."
Livy was staring.
"There are rumors of the last warlock, but I've never seen Tessa here in Los Angeles. I don't even know if she really exists."
"I have a way to contact her," Emma held up her hand.
"This ring. Maybe it will work here. It's worth a shot."
Livy looked from the ring to Emma. She spoke slowly.
"I remember that ring. You used to wear it. Brother Zachariah gave it to you while we were in Manhattan. But it was lost when Emma was lost."
A spark of hope flared in Emma's heart.
"He gave it to me in my world, too," said Emma.
"It could work here if Tessa still has the other one."
Livy didn't say anything. Emma had a feeling she'd long ago given up believing things were worth a shot.
"Let me just try," Emma said, and swung her left hand hard against one of the concrete pillars.
The glass bauble in the ring smashed, and the metal of the ring darkened, suddenly splotched with markings like rust or blood. The prongs that had held the glass disappeared. The ring was now just a metal band. Livy exhaled.
"Real magic," she said. "I haven't seen that in a long time."
"Seems like a good sign," said Julian. "If Tessa is still here, she might have powers that still work."
It seemed like a spiderweb thin string to hang hope on, Emma thought. But what else did they have? Livy went over to one of the desks and returned with Emma's phone.
"Here you go," she said a little reluctantly.
Keep it if you want, Emma said.
She knew Julian was looking at her, his eyebrows raised in surprise.
Really? The battery's dying anyway, Livy said. But there was something else in her voice, something that said it hurt to look at the pictures of a life that had been taken from her.
Ty grew up so handsome, she said.
The girls must be all over him. Or the boys, she added with a sideways smile that faded quickly.
Anyway, you take it.
Emma put the phone into her pocket.
As Libby turned away, Emma thought she caught sight of the edge of a black mark just under the collar of Libby's t-shirt. She blinked.
Weren't there no marks here? It looked like the curlicue of a mourning rune.
Libby flopped back down on the couch.
Well, there's no point waiting here, she said. It'll just make us tense. You guys go and get some sleep. If nothing happens by tomorrow afternoon, we can regroup.
Emma and Julian made for the exit. At the door, Julian hesitated.
I was wondering, he said. Is this place any better by daylight?
Livy had been studying her hands with their patterns of scars. She raised her eyes, and for a moment they blazed, familiar blackthorn blue.
Just you wait, she said.
Pajamas didn't seem to be a thing in Thule. After showering, Julian sat on the bed in a pair of sweatpants and a t-shirt, staring at the painted metal window with its false silver stars. He was thinking of Mark. When Mark had been a captive of the Wild Hunt, every night he had counted out his brothers' and sisters' names on the points of light wheeling above. In Thule, you couldn't see the stars. What had Livy done? How had she remembered them all? Or had it been less painful to try to forget? Mark had thought his siblings were alive and happy without him. Livy knew they were dead or in thrall. Which was worse?
She didn't ask, he said as Emma came out of the bathroom in her tank top and a pair of boxer briefs. Livy, she didn't ask about our world. Nothing at all. Emma sank onto the bed beside him. She had pulled her hair back in a braid. He could feel the warmth of her and smell the soap on her skin. His insides tightened.
Can you blame her? Our world's not perfect, but it isn't this. It isn't a whole world of birthdays she missed, and growing up she didn't get to see, and comfort she never got.
She's alive here, though, Julian said.
Julian, Emma touched his face lightly.
He wanted to lean into the touch, but he held himself back with a body-tensing effort.
She's surviving here. And there's a difference?
She gave him a long look before dropping her hand and settling back against the pillows.
You know there is.
She lay on her side, tendrils of pale hair escaping from her braid, gold against the white pillows. Her eyes were the color of polished wood, her body curved like a violin.
Julian wanted to grab his sketchpad to draw her, the way he always had when his feelings for her grew too intense. His heart exploded, paint and colors, because he could not speak the words.
Do you want me to sleep on the floor? He asked. His voice was husky. Nothing he could do about that.
She shook her head, still looking at him with those enormous eyes.
I was thinking, she said. If Shadowhunter magic is gone here, if Seraph blades don't work, or angelic magic,
then our parabatai bond is probably broken, he finished. I thought of that, too.
But we can't be sure, she said.
I mean, I guess we could try to do something to make something happen, the way we burned down that church.
Probably not a good idea to experiment with arson. Julian could feel his heart beating.
Emma was leaning closer to him. He could see the smooth curve of her collarbone. A place where her tanned skin grew paler. He dragged his gaze away.
We could try the other thing, she said. You know, kissing.
Emma. I feel it when we kiss. Her pupils were enormous. I know you do, too. the bond. It was like having helium pumped into his blood. He felt light as air. You sure? You absolutely want this? Yeah.
She settled back further into the pillows. She was looking up at him now, her stubborn chin tilted up, her elbows on the bed. Her legs sprawled out, long and glorious. He slid closer to her. He could see her pulse beating in her throat, her lips parted, her voice low.
I want this.
He moved over her, not touching her yet, his body a whisper from hers. He saw her eyes darken. She wriggled under him, her legs sliding against his.
Emma, he rasped, what happened to that bra? You know, the enormous one.
She grinned.
I went without.
The air in the room felt suddenly superheated.
Julian tried to breathe normally, despite knowing that if he slid his hands up under Emma's tank top, he would encounter only soft skin and bare curves. But she hadn't asked him to do that. She'd asked for a kiss. He propped himself over her, a hand on either side of her head. Slowly he lowered himself, exquisitely slowly, until their mouths were an inch apart. He could feel her warm breath against his face. Still, their bodies were barely touching. She moved restlessly under him, her fingers digging into the coverlet.
Kiss me,
she murmured.
He bent to brush his lips over hers. Just a brush, the lightest of touches. She chased his lips with her own. He turned his face to the side, tracing the same warm, light touch along her jaw, her cheek. When he reached her mouth again, she was gasping, her eyes half closed. He drew her lower lip into his mouth, running his tongue along it, tracing the curve, the sensitive corners. She gasped again, pressed her back deeper into the cushions, her body arching. He felt her breasts brush against his chest, sending a shot of heat directly to his groin. He dug his fingers into the mattress, willing himself to keep control, to give her only and exactly what she'd asked for. A kiss. He sucked and licked at her bottom lip, tracing the bow shape of the upper. Licked along the seam of the two until her lips parted and he sealed his mouth to hers, all heat and wetness and the taste of her mint and tea. She wrapped her hands around his biceps, arching up against him as they kissed on and on. Her body was soft and warm. She was moaning into his mouth, dragging her heels up the backs of his calves, her hands sliding to his shirt, fingers curling under. She broke away. She was breathing as if she'd been running a marathon, her lips damp and pink from kissing, her cheeks flaming.
Holy f-,
she began, then coughed and blushed.
Have you been practicing?
No,
Julian said. He was proud of himself for managing an entire syllable. He decided to try out a sentence.
I have not.
Okay, Emma breathed. Okay. No one's on fire. No parabatai weirdness in evidence. That's about as much testing as I'm up for right now.
Julian rolled carefully onto his side. But I can still sleep on the bed, right? Her lips curled into a smile.
I think you've earned that, yeah.
I can scooch all the way to the edge, he offered.
Don't push it, Julian,
she said and rolled against him, her body curling into his. He put his arms tentatively around her, and she burrowed closer, closing her eyes. Emma, he said. No answer.
He couldn't believe it.
She was asleep, breathing softly and regularly, her small, cold nose pressed into his collarbone. She was asleep, and he felt like his whole body was burning up. The shuddering waves of pleasure and desire that had rolled over him just from kissing her still stunned him. That it felt good. Almost euphorically good. And not just because of what had bloomed inside his own cells, his own skin. It had been Emma. The noises she'd made,
the way she'd touched him. It wasn't the Parabatai bond, but it was their bond. It was the pleasure he'd given her, mirrored back at him a thousandfold. It was everything he hadn't been able to feel since the spell. The queen's voice came, unwanted, silvery as a bell and flawed with malice. "You are in that cage, boy." He shivered and drew Emma closer.
Chapter 19. The Jeweled Dead.
Emma dreamed of fire and thunder and was woken up by the sound of splintering wood. At least it sounded like the wood was splintering. When she sat up, groggy and confused, Julian's arm still around her waist, she realized it was someone knocking very, very hard at the bedroom door. Julian moved, groaning softly in his sleep. Emma extricated herself and padded over to throw the door open, expecting Cameron or Livy. It was Diana. The sight of her acted like a shot of caffeine. She was all in black, from her black motorcycle boots to her leather pants and jacket. Her hair was secured in a tight, curly ponytail at the back of her head. She looked intimidating, but Emma didn't care much. She gave a little yelp and threw her arms around Diana, who made a loud noise of surprise. "Whoa there, stranger," she said. "What's going on?" "Sorry," Julian had appeared and gently peeled Emma away. "In our world, you're our tutor." "Oh, right. Your alternate dimension. Livy told me about it when I got back from my pharmacy run." Diana raised her eyebrows. "Wild." "Do you know us at all here?" Emma asked with some disappointment.
"Not since you were little kids. I saw you at the Accords Hall during the Dark War, before they portaled all the children away. You were good little fighters," she added. "Then I heard you got endarkened. I didn't expect I'd see you again unless you were pointing the business end of a gun at me."
"Well," Emma said, "good surprise, huh?"
Diana looked darkly amused.
"Come on, you can tell me what I'm like in your world while I take you to the lobby."
They threw on clothes, boots and long-sleeved shirts, bomber jackets. Emma wondered where the rebels got their supplies. Her black pants felt like they were made out of canvas or something else similarly thick and itchy. The boots were cool, though, and she had to admit she liked the way Julian wore his faded shirt and army pants. They clung to his lean, muscular body in a way that made her try not to think about the previous night. As they left the room, Julian tore a page from his sketchbook and tucked it into his jacket pocket. "For luck," he said. They joined Diana in the hallway, their boots clomping loudly on the polished wood.
"In our world," Emma said as they headed down a set of stairs, "you're dating a fairy."
Diana frowned.
"A fairy? Why would I be dating a traitor?"
"Things are a little more complicated at home."
"Things are pretty complicated here, kid," Diana said as they reached the ground floor. "Come on through."
They passed under a brick archway and into a massive room full of furniture that looked like it had been scrounged from different offices. There were modern steel and leather couches and vintage patchwork and velvet ones. Armchairs made of cotton and chintz, some in good shape and some torn up. Cheap chipboard tables on metal legs laid end to end to create a sort of boardroom effect. There was a crowd in the room. Emma saw Livy and Cameron, Bat and Maya, and a few familiar faces, Divya Joshi and Rayan Maduabachi, one or two of the older Los Angeles Conclave members. They were all staring at the east wall of the room. Ordinary brick and sandstone, it was currently burning with huge, fiery letters, reaching from one end of the wall to the other. "Seek church."
"Do you understand it?" Diana said. "Nobody here does. Churches aren't doing well in this world. They're all deconsecrated and full of demons."
"Everyone's so quiet," Emma said, whispering herself. "Are they scared?"
"Not really," said Diana. "I think it's just been so long since any of us have seen magic."
Livy pushed her way through the crowd toward them, leaving Cameron behind.
"Is this from Tessa Gray?" she demanded, eyes wide as she reached them. "Is this a response to that summons? Did it work?"
Yeah, Julian said. I'm pretty sure that's exactly what this is. Tessa wants us to come to her. Not too trusting, said Diana. She must have some sense.
But the church part, Livy looked puzzled. What church does she mean?
She means a cat, said Julian.
Then please don't say all the cats are dead, said Emma. I'm not sure I can cope with feline death on a massive scale.
Cats actually do okay here, said Diana. They're a little demony themselves. Libby waved her hands. Can we stick to specifics? What do you mean, a cat? An unusual cat, said Julian. His name's Church. He belonged to Jem Carstairs once, and he used to live with us in the Institute after the Dark War.
We can't go to the Institute, said Emma. It's full of evil ashdowns.
Yeah, but Church was a wandering cat, you remember, Julian said. He didn't really live in the Institute with us. He padded around on the beach and stopped by whenever he felt like it. And he led us where he wanted us to go. If we find Church, he could lead us to Tessa.
Tessa and Brother Zachariah did have a foul-tempered cat with them in New York after the war, said Libby.
I'll go with you to the beach, Diana said.
That means you have to cross the whole city in daylight, Libby said. I don't like it.
Would it be safer to go at night? Said Julian.
Nope, that's even worse, Libby said.
Hey, said a soft voice.
Emma turned to see a boy with wavy hair and light brown skin looking at them with a mixture of annoyance and... No, it was mostly just annoyance.
Raphael Santiago, she said.
She recognized him from the Dark War, from pictures and history books about its heroes. Emma had always thought that Raphael, who had made his famous sacrifice to save Magnus Bane's life, had an angelic face. The crown of curls, the cross scar at his throat, and the wide eyes and the child-round face were the same. She had not expected the sardonic expression overlaying all that.
I know who you are, Emma said.
He didn't look impressed.
I know who you are, too. You're those in Darkened who always make a disgusting display of yourselves. I realize you are evil, but why can't you be more discreet?
That's really not us, said Julian. Those are different people.
So you say, said Raphael. This is a stupid plan, and you are all going to die. I see all the angels' gifts are truly gone, leaving only the Nephilim gift of remarkable short-sightedness. Out of the demonic frying pan, right back into the demonic frying pan.
Are you saying we shouldn't answer Tessa's summons? Said Emma, who was starting to get annoyed.
Raphael's just in a bad mood, said Libby.
She ruffled Raphael's curly hair.
Aren't you in a bad mood? She cooed. Raphael glared daggers at her.
Libby smiled.
I didn't say you should or shouldn't do anything, Raphael snapped. Go ahead and look for Tessa, but you might want my help. You're a lot more likely to make it across the city if you have transportation. But my help's not for free.
Annoyingly, everything he says is true, Livy admitted.
Okay, said Julian. What do you want, vampire?
Information, said Raphael. In your world, is my city still standing? New York?
Julian nodded.
Am I alive? Raphael said.
No, said Emma. There didn't seem to be any point in beating around the bush. Raphael paused only for a moment.
Then who is the leader of the New York vampire clan there? Said Raphael.
Lily Chen, Emma said. Raphael smiled, surprising her. It was a real smile, with real fondness in it. Emma felt herself soften.
In our world, you're a hero. You sacrificed your life so Magnus could live, she said.
Raphael looked horrified.
Tell me you're not talking about Magnus Bane.
Tell me you're talking about a much cooler Magnus. I would never do that. If I did do that, I would never want anyone to talk about it. I cannot believe Magnus would shame me by talking about that.
Julian's mouth twitched at the corner.
He named his child for you, Raphael Santiago Lightwood Bane.
That is revolting. So everybody knows?
I'm so embarrassed.
He looked at Diana.
Under the tarp in the garage are several of my motorcycles.
Take two of them. Do not crash them, or I will be very angry.
Noted, said Diana. We'll have them back by nightfall.
Shouldn't you be asleep, Raphael? Said Emma, suddenly struck. You're a vampire. It's daytime.
Raphael smiled coldly.
Oh, little shadow hunter, he said. Wait until you see the sun.
They found the motorcycles in the garage, as Raphael had said they would, and Divya opened the metal door so they could wheel the cycles onto the street. She closed it up quickly after them, and to the sound of the clanging and whirring of gears, Julian looked up and saw the sky. His first thought was that he should step in front of Emma, protect her somehow from the ruins of the sun. His second was a fragmented memory of a piece of poetry his uncle had taught him. Morn came and went and came and brought no day. The sun was a red-black cinder, glowing dully across a bank of streaky clouds. It cast an ugly light, a reddish-brown light, as if they were seeing the world through blood-tinted water. The air was thick and carried the taste of dirt and copper on it. They were on what Julian guessed was West Broadway, the street much less crowded than it had been the night before. The occasional shadows slunk in and out of the gaps between buildings, and the convenience store offering blood milkshakes was, surprisingly, open. Something was sitting behind the counter reading an old magazine, but it wasn't shaped like a human being. Trash blew up and down the mostly empty street, carried on the heated wind. This kind of weather came sometimes in Los Angeles, when the wind blew from the desert. Los Angelinos called them devil winds, or murder winds. Maybe they came all the time in Thule.
You ready? Said Diana, throwing one leg over her cycle and gesturing to the second one.
Julian had never ridden a motorcycle. He was willing to have a whack at it, but Emma had already climbed on. She zipped up a leather jacket she'd taken from the wardrobe and crooked a finger at Julian.
Mark showed me how to ride one of these, she said. Remember?
Julian remembered. He remembered how jealous of Mark he'd been, too. Mark, who could flirt with Emma casually, who could kiss her, embrace her, while Julian had to treat her like a bomb that would explode if he touched her, if they touched each other. But not here, he reminded himself. This might be hell, but they weren't Parabatai here. He settled himself on the cycle behind Emma and slipped his arms around her waist. She had a Glock thrust through her belt, just like he did. She reached down to brush her fingers across his clasped hands where they rested above her belt. He ducked his head and kissed the back of her neck. She shivered.
Enough, you guys, Diana said. Let's go.
She took off and Emma started up her own cycle, pulling in the clutch while holding down the start button. The engine revved with a loud noise, and they were hurtling after Diana down the deserted street. Diana gunned her cycle toward the hill. Emma crouched down low, and Julian did the same.
Hold on,
Emma shouted into the wind, and their cycle lifted off the ground, angling into the air. The ground fell away below them, and they were soaring, Diana beside them. Julian couldn't help thinking of the Wild Hunt, of flying through the air above a sleeping England, riding a path of wind and stars. But this was different. From above, they could see the utter destruction of the city clearly. The sky was filled with wheeling, dark figures, other airborne motorcycles, and demons abroad at daylight, protected by the dim sun and the thick cover of clouds. Fires burned at intervals, smoke swirling up from the Miracle Mile. The streets around Beverly Hills had been dammed up and flooded, forming a sort of moat around Bel Air, and as they soared over it, Julian gazed down into the churning water. A massive sea monster, hideous and humped, was pulling its way along the moat by its tentacles. It threw back its head and howled, and Julian glimpsed a black, yawning mouth, studded with teeth like a great white shark's. They soared over Wilshire, which had become a boulevard of horrors.
Julian glimpsed a human musician dangling from puppet strings made of his own nerves and blood vessels, being forced to play a mandolin even as he screamed in agony. A demon lounged at a covered table where xylophones of human ribs were for sale. Another, a massive one-eyed serpent, coiled around a lemonade stand where vampires stepped up for a wedge of lemon and a bite of a screaming, terrified human. Julian closed his eyes. When he opened them again, they were flying north over the highway by the sea. At least here it was mostly deserted, though they could see down into the ruins of the once wealthy houses that had lined the shores of Malibu. They were overgrown now, their swimming pools empty or full of black water. Even the ocean looked different. In the dim daylight, the water was black and churning, without fish or seaweed to be seen. He felt Emma tense. Her words were torn away by the wind, but he caught enough of them to understand.
Julian! The Institute!
He glanced to the east. There it was, their Institute. Glass and stone and steel rising from the scrub grass of the Santa Monica Mountains. His heart lurched with yearning. It seemed so familiar, even under the red-orange hell glow of the dying sun. But no. Two flags flew from the Institute's roof. One showed the star and circle symbol of Sebastian, and the other the family crest of the Ash Downs, an ash tree surrounded by leaves. He was glad when Emma swung the cycle around and the Institute was no longer in view. Diana was ahead of them, her cycle descending toward the beach. She landed with a few puffs of sand and turned to watch as Emma and Julian lurched down after her with considerably less grace. They hit the sand with enough force to snap Julian's teeth sharply together. "Ouch," he said. Emma swung around, her cheeks pink, her hair windblown.
"You think you could do better?"
"No," he said, and kissed her cheek. Her face turned a darker pink, and Diana made an exasperated noise.
"You two are almost as bad as the undarkened versions of yourselves. Now come on, we have to hide these cycles."
As Julian rolled their cycle under a rock overhang, he realized he didn't mind Diana's teasing at all. He hadn't minded Cameron's teasing about the bed either. It was all a reminder that here, he and Emma had a completely normal relationship. Nothing secret, nothing forbidden, nothing dangerous. It was perhaps the only thing in Thule that was ordinary, but in this world, without angels, it felt like a blessing.
"Well, here we are," Diana said once the cycles were hidden, "looking for a cat on a beach."
"Church usually comes to us," said Julian, glancing around. "It looks almost ordinary here."
"I wouldn't go into the water," said Diana darkly. "But yeah, Sebastian seems to like the beach. Mostly he leaves it alone and uses it for ceremonies and executions."
Emma began to make cooing, clicking, kitty-come-here noises.
"Don't blame me if you summon a cat demon," said Diana.
She stretched, the joints in her wrists popping audibly.
"A week to get back from Mexico City and now this. 2 days after I get home," she said half to herself. "I really thought I might get a chance to rest. Silly me."
Emma whirled around.
"Mexico City?" she demanded. Do you know if Cristina Mendoza Rosales is all right?"
"Cristina Rosales? The Rose of Mexico?" Diana said, looking surprised. "Because of her, Mexico City is one of the few Shadow Hunter strongholds left. I mean, there's no angelic magic, but they patrol. They keep the demons down. The Rosales family are a resistance legend."
"I knew it," Emma said.
She wiped hastily at her damp face.
"I knew it."
"Are there other pockets? Places people are resisting?" Julian said.
"Livy's doing what she can here," said Diana, somewhat pointedly. "There'd be a lot more dead if not for her. We hear things about Jerusalem, Singapore, Sri Lanka. Oh, and Bangkok, which doesn't surprise me. I know that city pretty well since I transitioned there."
Emma looked puzzled.
What do you mean transitioned?
I'm transgender, Diana said, puzzled. You must know that if you knew me in your world.
Right, Julian said hastily. We just didn't know about the Bangkok thing.
Diana looked even more puzzled.
But when I... She broke off. Is that what I think it is?
She pointed. Sitting on top of a nearby boulder was a cat. Not just any cat. An angry-looking blue Persian cat with an aggressively fluffed-out tail.
Church!
Emma scooped him up in her arms, and Church did what he usually did. He went limp.
Is that cat dead? Diana demanded.
No, he isn't, Emma cooed and kissed his furry face. Church went limper. He just hates affection.
Diana shook her head. She seemed completely unaffected by having told them something that in their world was a secret she had guarded.
Guilt and annoyance with himself were rising inside Julian. He tried to shove them down. Now wasn't the time, nor would it be right to burden this Diana with his feelings.
I love you,
Emma said to Church.
I love you very much.
Church wiggled out of her grasp and meowed. He padded toward Julian, meowed again, and then turned to frisk away along the beach.
He wants us to follow him, Julian said, clomping after Church. His enormous boots were a pain when it came to walking on sand.
He heard Diana mutter something about how, if she wanted to run around after deranged animals, she would have volunteered for the zoo patrol, but she headed after them anyway. They trailed Church along the inner bluffs until they reached a path that led to a hole in the cliff face. Julian knew it well. When you grew up on the beach, you explored every rock, arch, cove, and cave. This one led to an impressive but empty cave, if he recalled correctly. He and Emma had once dragged a table in there and held meetings before they'd gotten bored with having a secret society with only two people in it. Church scrambled up to the entrance of the cave and meowed loudly. There was a grinding sound like stone moving aside, and a figure stepped out of the shadows. It was a man with dark hair in long parchment robes. His cheeks were scarred, his eyes dark, full of wisdom and sorrow.
Jim!
Emma screamed and began to run up the path, her face shining with eagerness. Jim held up his hand. His palms were scarred with runes, and Julian ached to see them. Runes in this runeless place. Insight, quietude, courage. And then, Jem began to change. Diana swore and yanked a pistol from her belt as a ripple went over Jem's features and the parchment robes slid to the ground. His hair lightened and tumbled, long and waving to the middle of his back. His eyes turned gray and long-lashed, his figure curved and feminine inside a plain gray dress. Diana cocked the pistol.
Who are you?
Emma had stopped in the middle of the path. She blinked back tears and said,
This is her, the last warlock. This is Tessa Gray.
Tessa had set the inside of the cave up as cozily as possible. There was a small fireplace whose smoke went up a flue built into the rocks. The stone floor was brushed clean and dotted with carpets. There was a small sleeping annex and multiple chairs covered in cushions and soft pillows. There was even a little kitchen with a small range, a refrigerator humming along without being plugged into anything, and a wooden table already set with teacups and a loaf of warm, sweet bread. Realizing she hadn't had breakfast, Emma wondered if it would be a faux pas to leap on the bread and devour it. Probably.
Sit down and eat, Tessa said, as if reading her mind.
As they settled around the table, Church climbed onto Emma's lap, rolled onto his back, and promptly fell asleep with his feet in the air. Diana tore off a hunk of the bread and stuffed it in her mouth. She closed her eyes in bliss.
Oh, my God.
Emma decided that was her cue. For the next minute, she shut out the world around her and entered a blissful carb coma.
The last time she'd eaten real food was in that clearing with Julian, and this was warm and home-cooked and felt like the taste of hope. When she opened her eyes, she realized Julian hadn't even taken a bite yet. He was looking at Tessa, that Julian look that seemed completely innocent but actually meant he was taking someone's measure, assessing their weaknesses and deciding if he trusted them. It was pretty hot, actually. Emma sucked a piece of sugar off her thumb and tried not to smile to herself. "You must be wondering who we are," he said as Tessa poured their tea.
"No." Tessa set the teapot down and took a seat, wrapping a shawl around her shoulders. "I know who you are. You are Emma Carstairs and Julian Blackthorne, but not the ones from this world."
"You already know that?" said Diana in surprise.
"I see as a warlock sees," said Tessa.
"I know they do not belong here," she indicated Julian and Emma.
"And I have seen a little into other worlds, into their world in particular. It is closer to this one than we might like to think."
"What do you mean?" Julian said. "They seem pretty different to me."
"There are stress points in history," said Tessa. "Places where a great deal of chance is at play. Battles, peace treaties, marriages, that sort of thing. That's where timelines are likely to split. Our two timelines split at the Battle of the Burren. In your world, the demon Lilith was too weak to render Sebastian Morgenstern much help. In Thule, another demon gave aid and strength to Lilith. She was able to kill Clary Fairchild. And that's where our timeline split. Only 7 years ago." "So this is what our world would be like without Clary," said Emma.
Remembering all the time she'd heard people, mostly men, say that Clary wasn't a hero. That she hadn't done much that deserved to be praised. That she was selfish, even worthless. Just a girl who had been in the right places at the right times.
"Yes," said Tessa. "Interesting, isn't it? I gather that in your world, Jace Herondale is a hero. Here, he's a monster, second only to Sebastian."
"Doesn't he even care that Sebastian let Lilith kill Clary?" demanded Emma. "Even when Jace was in thrall to Sebastian in our world, he loved Clary."
"Sebastian claims the death of Clary was not what he wanted," said Tessa. "He says he murdered Lilith as revenge for her taking of Clary's life."
"Not sure anyone believes that but Jace," said Diana.
"He's the only one who has to," said Tessa. She ran her fingers around the rim of her teacup. "I must apologize for testing you," she said abruptly. "I appeared as Jem when you arrived because I knew that the real Emma Carstairs would be delighted to see him, while anyone aligned with Sebastian would be horrified at the sight of a silent brother."
"Jem?" Emma whispered. She knew what Livy had said, that all the brothers were gone, but still she had hoped. Tessa didn't look up.
"He died in the attempt to seal the Silent City. It was successful, but he gave his life to hold off Sebastian's Indarkand, as the brothers made their last stand to protect the mortal instruments."
"I'm sorry," Julian said.
Emma remembered Tessa and Jem in her own world, eyes only for each other. Tessa cleared her throat. "Sebastian already has possession of the mortal mirror, Lake Lynn. It is surrounded by demons, 10,000 strong. No one can go anywhere near it."
"Why is he guarding the lake so fiercely?" said Emma. "If no one can get to any of the mortal instruments."
"As the warlocks were sickening, we found that the water of Lake Lynn could neutralize the blight that was eating through our world. We raced there to collect the water, but by the time we arrived at the lake, Sebastian had surrounded it with countless demons." Emma and Julian exchanged a look.
"With the blight gone, would the warlocks have been cured?"
"We believe so," said Tessa. "We had a small amount of the water and used it to cure the blight around the spiral labyrinth.
We even gave it to some warlocks mixed with ordinary water, and they began to improve. But it simply wasn't enough. The warlocks began to sicken and turn again. We could not save them.
Emma's heart thumped. If the water of Lake Lynn had neutralized some of the blight here in Thule, if it had helped the warlocks, even as this world was turning to demonic poison all around them, surely the water of their own Lake Lynn, in their own world, might be a cure?
They needed to get home more desperately than ever. But first, we need your help, Emma said. That's why we called on you.
I guess that. Tessa rested her chin in her hand. She looked young, no more than 20, though Emma knew she was over 100.
Is it that you want to get back to your world?
It's not just that, Julian said. We need to get into the Silent City. We have to get to the Mortal Cup and the Mortal Sword before Sebastian does.
And then what? Tessa said.
And then we destroy them, so Sebastian can't use them, said Emma.
Tessa raised her eyebrows. Destroy the mortal instruments? They're very nearly indestructible.
Emma thought of the mortal sword shattering under Cortana's blade.
If you open up a portal back to our world, we can take them through with us. Sebastian will never be able to find them.
If it was that simple, Tessa said sharply, I would have already opened a portal, leapt through it, and taken the cup and the sword with me.
To open a portal between worlds, that is complex, powerful magic, far beyond most warlocks. I can see into your world, but I cannot reach it.
But you can get into the Silent City, right? Said Emma.
I believe so, though I have not tried, said Tessa.
I thought the sword and the cup were safe there. The Silent Brothers died to protect the instruments, and to remove them would have left them vulnerable to Sebastian.
Yet now he is close to breaking the seal on the doors, she frowned. If you can truly bring the instruments back to your world, then they would be safer there.
But without the knowledge that a portal can be opened, there is another way to end the threat.
What do you mean? Said Julian. There's nothing we could do with a sword or cup here besides demonic magic.
People used to say that the mortal sword could kill Sebastian, said Diana, her gaze sharp.
But that's not true, is it? I was at the last battle of Idris. I saw Isabel Lightwood take up the mortal sword and deal Sebastian an incredible blow.
He wasn't even nicked. He struck her down instead.
Awe akwe wale Isabel Lightwood. Tessa closed her eyes.
You have to understand. By then, the invulnerability granted to Sebastian by Lilith had grown so strong, no warrior of this earth could slay him. But there is something most do not know. Even Sebastian does not know it. She opened her eyes. He is tied to Thule, and Thule to him. A warrior of this world cannot slay him with the sword. But the Silent Brothers knew that did not hold true for a warrior who was not of Thule. They locked the sword away, hoping for a day when a warrior would arrive from heaven and end Sebastian's reign. For a long moment, she gazed intently at Emma and Julian.
We're not from heaven, Emma said, despite what some bad pickup lines I've heard over the years might have you believe.
Seems like heaven compared to here, said Diana.
We can't wait forever to be rescued by angels, Tessa said. This is a gift, you being here.
Let's be clear. Julian took a bite of bread. His face was expressionless, but Emma could read his eyes, knew the gears were whirling in his brain. You're asking us to kill Sebastian.
I have to ask, Tessa said. I have to make Jem's sacrifice mean something.
In our world, Julian said, the bond between Jace and Sebastian meant that killing Jace would destroy Sebastian.